Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
EU Startups Podcast is brought to you by Vonta. If you're building a SaaS business, achieving compliance with SOC 2, ISO 27001, or other in-demand frameworks can unlock major growth for your company and establish customer trust. However, this process is often time-intensive and costly. Vonta automates your compliance work, getting you audit ready quickly and saving you up to 85% of associated costs. And Vonta scales with your business, helping you continuously monitor compliance, unify risk management, and streamline security reviews. Join 8,000 global companies like Synethia, Flow Health, and Alica Bank that use Vonta to build trust and prove security in real time. Our audience gets a special offer of $1,000 off Vonta at vonta.com/EU startups. That's vonta.com/EU startups.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups podcast. My guest today is Steve Chen, the co-founder and former chief technology officer of YouTube. Steve, welcome to the show. It's amazing to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you for the warm welcome.
Steve, so we were just chatting, off the record about what does it take and is it even possible to recreate the Silicon Valley ecosystem, the Silicon Valley culture elsewhere? Like you were talking about Asia, Taiwan, and we were talking about Poland as well. Maybe you can tell us more about it.
Yeah, I mean, as we were kind of saying earlier, for the I'm based currently, I would say, based in Asia now, specifically Taiwan, and that's been the case since 2019. Of course, that wasn't the original goal. Just like moving to Silicon Valley in 1999, I didn't intend to be there for 20 years, but that's where I did first spend 20 years in Silicon Valley, going from PayPal, joining that group with the PayPal mafia, including, you know, all the folks that are all the startups that have come out of that. And of course, the biggest for me personally was creating YouTube and then working with Google after the acquisition, Google Ventures, so on. But in 2019, after 20 years in Silicon Valley, we were just, I had a family then with two kids, and we were remodeling our kitchen. That was it. And this was still before COVID. So it was a very different environment. It was originally thinking that we were just going to stay in Silicon Valley in the San Francisco Bay Area for the rest of our lives, right? But because we were remodeling the kitchen, we couldn't stay in the house that we were living at. And so we had to move out of the house. And just as a kind of the same kind of adventurous personality that I had in moving to Silicon Valley for the first time, I just thought it would be a great opportunity. And if you have those opportunities, you have to seize it because it may not exist again. So 100%. I said, like, wouldn't it be great to be able to bring the kids and the family to somewhere like Asia where they get to just be in a, and maybe this is the only time in the in all of our lives where we get to live in Asia. But the original goal there was, as soon as the kitchen remodel was finished, we moved back to Silicon Valley. Yeah. Well, now it's what, 2024, 5 to 6 years later, we're still here in Asia. And of course, COVID was a big factor in that. But even after everything lifted with COVID and we had the ability to move back, I found out that there are other parts of the world that are just as exciting for even some of my own personal interests, personal passions, when it comes to startups, when it comes to creating new ideas, when it comes to meeting new entrepreneurs. That's different in many ways from Silicon Valley, but just as exciting, you know? And so I think that I continue to work out here. But when we were talking earlier in the conversation, there are many other parts around the world that are actually finding that they too can be the establishment, the place where the next wave of big global startups where the seeds are going to be planted. So I think it's a very exciting period right now for the entire world when it comes to startups.
Amazing. Steve, so YouTube started, getting back to YouTube, YouTube started as a dating platform. Correct me if I'm wrong. What was the original vision, and how did you realize it needed to pivot? Maybe any advice, you know, for aspiring founders and recognizing the right moment to pivot?
Yeah, so I'll answer that with first, yes, you're correct. For the first week that the YouTube app, the iPhone wasn't even invented back then in 2005. So the YouTube website was supposed to be a dating site. But I think that I should say that just about every startup, and especially as you get into the more consumer space startups, every startup has different elements and different layers to it, right? And I think that from a the deep down at the lowest layers, you have the architecture, the platform, the engineering. And for YouTube, that was quite difficult at the time for YouTube. When it comes to back in 2005, we just weren't sure if the internet was going to have enough broadband, bandwidth to be able to do live streaming instead of downloading the videos, right? This was still at a time when broadband was still relatively new. It didn't get to the penetration that you're seeing nowadays. You had to still call up many people using their modems. This was still a couple years before the iPhone came out. So in order to just even take videos, you had to buy a digital camera, take the card out, you know, plug it to your computer, upload it to YouTube. You couldn't do it on the fly. You didn't have any video editing software. And then I think the most important thing that YouTube did was to be able to do this idea of doing this real-time transcoding of the video. So when the videos were uploaded, we would instantly transcode the videos into a format that you could watch inside the browser. And even that technology was new in that it was only a few months before the official launch of YouTube in 2005 that it became a standard to be able to watch a video inside the browser. And all of these things were part of the technical part of the YouTube startup, right? But then I think what we needed to do was, okay, we have the technology figured out to be able to allow for real-time uploading of videos, real-time transcoding of videos, real-time embedding of videos onto other sites other than just YouTube, so you can watch the YouTube video in other sites. But then we need a product market fit. We need a market that actually needs to upload videos. And that was the hard part for us. And so we chose, like I think many, many startups, we just said, okay, well, maybe dating is going to be the one choice where people want to share more than just photos of themselves, more than just text messages introducing themselves. Maybe they could actually have a video that introduces themselves. So we said, we're going to create the first video dating site. But after a week went by, we received zero videos. And we just said, okay, well, before we give up, why don't we make this more generic just to say, any video that you want to upload to YouTube, you can upload it. And that's when we started seeing a lot more videos being, at least experimentation, more videos being uploaded, more videos being embedded onto other platforms, and then more people coming to watch these videos.
Amazing. Steve, so, you know, YouTube grew super fast, and you were at the center of it as a chief technology officer. What was your biggest, like, oh shit moment during that growth phase, and how did you handle it?
There were really two. I think that one, it was more of the problem that I was seeing wearing my chief technical officer hat, and then the other one was more seeing it from more of the co-founder of the company hat. From a CTO standpoint, it was really, is the internet ready for this? Can you scale this out? Is the bandwidth going to be too expensive? Is the storage going to be too expensive? Is the transcoding of the videos from the 200 different types of video codecs and audio codecs into the one format that's going to be compatible across all the browsers, was that going to take too much CPU time? Was the power going to be too much? And all those actually we weren't sure about, because YouTube really was the first service to be trying to do this on a general level across the board for anybody that wanted to upload a video, hit the upload button, we'll accept your video. Over a period of the year and a half to 2 years, especially by the time that the acquisition happened between Google and YouTube, we figured it out that we were able to scale up. But I think with many things, as you'll see in AI these days, bandwidth continues to drop. This is back then, 2005. Bandwidth prices continue to drop because more and more people are coming on to and using the internet, right? CPUs continue to go up in, you know, Moore's Law. It continues to just get more and more powerful with the CPU transcoding. And more people were just able to create videos. And so that part of it, over a period of time, as YouTube grew, the rest of the infrastructure also scaled up. So at the time that we went from a startup to the time that we sold and was acquired by Google, that part of it became more and more manageable. The part that's more of not wearing the chief technical officer hat, but more of the co-founder hat, was the rest of the industry ready for YouTube? And why, by that specifically, it was, you know, figuring out on the legal side, on the, you know, the monetization side, on the licensing side, on the international licensing side. So when a piece of audio that is embedded into a video clip that somebody uploaded from California, can that be viewed around the world? Or does that person have access to use that Lady Gaga music clip in their video? And it's questions like that that was hard for us to figure out as co-founders and as a company. And it really, I would think, like the industry, even at that time, was just not ready. They weren't ready to see what was going to be happening to the way that media was going to be distributed 15 years, 10 years, 5 years later. So that part was the part that was not easy to solve for us when we were still an independent company.
So speaking about selling YouTube to Google, you sold YouTube to Google for $1.65 billion within 2 years of its funding. What went through your mind during the acquisition? What were the hardest decisions you faced before sealing the deal?
Now, I think the two. I mean, again, it's whether the time was right and whether or not Google was the right acquirer, right? And if I were to say that hindsight is always 20/20, and you look back the 20 plus years later and you look back at whether or not that decision was the right decision at the right time, even today, I still get people kind of ridiculing me or us for making that decision, asking us, do you regret selling it for just $1.65 billion? But I think that it's important to place, you know, yourself in that situation back in 2006, 2007, when it was still a period when monetization was not possible, right? The rev share system with the content creators, that model still didn't exist yet. Yes, YouTube was getting a lot of traffic. YouTube was getting a lot of content creators uploading content, but it still had to figure out many, many other pieces that were only figured out after the acquisition went through. And I think that in many ways, Google did a fantastic job with the way that they prioritized making sure that the content creators were happy and making sure that the viewers and the users of the site were happy before they tried to monetize. And I think that's it's shown in the outcome, is that, you know, generally people are pretty happy with the service from content creators to the viewers. And that's a very difficult challenge for a service after 20 years, people still being happy with it.
100%. But do you ever wonder what, you know, would have happened if you didn't sell? Like, would you have handled YouTube's future differently? Or
I think that in fact, like many of the things, I think on the monetization side, it's definitely right. I think the revenue sharing with the content creators makes it so. And I think of it this way, is that there are within the larger ecosystem of YouTube, I think that there are three parties that are engaged in the YouTube ecosystem. Yeah. And you have the general users, the viewers of the site, and that's all of us that's watching content on YouTube. You have the content creators, and there's a huge number of them, but a huge spectrum in terms of the content creators that are just creating content once they get it versus the content creators that are spending 100% of the time, plus they have a whole team that's helping them doing editing and everything, creating this content. And you need to make sure that they can do this and they can still pay and they can make it. It's worth their time and their commitment and their energy to be able to do this. But then you also have the advertisers and the marketers that are willing to put in and buy ads to be placed onto these YouTube videos for the watchers. And I think one of the biggest challenges is making all three of these parties happy at the same time. And I think that by creating this rev share system, you create a bridge with the content creators, the most important element, I would say, the people that are that have the creativity, the imagination to create this content, they're the bridge between they create the content that the viewers want to watch, and then they create the content that the advertisers want to buy ads for. And they're the bridge together, but they can also be benefiting from it because they need the viewers to be able to generate the revenue that the ads are pulling in. So I think they pull everybody in, and it's only with them that makes it a win-win-win for all the parties that are engaged.
100%. And speaking about users, so YouTube put, you know, a spotlight on user-generated content. What was the most unexpected consequence, good or bad, of putting so much power in the hands of creators?
So what do you mean? Like, as in the consequences of user-generated
outcome? Yeah. Like, mean that before, like, YouTube was kind of the first platform where you know, people could create their own content and express themselves and put it out there, and everyone in the world could watch it. You know, what surprised you the most about, like, because people couldn't do that previously, what surprised you the most, or maybe what was the, I don't know, the coolest outcome that you've seen on the out of it?
That's a great question. And I think the answer to that is still being defined now, right? Because I still think that a good example would be even my own kids, where they're app that they use to get their content to watch the content that the rest of their friends and classmates watch, they use YouTube. And that means that by using YouTube, they're not, for example, watching TV, or they're not going to the movie theater to watch movies, and they're getting their content from YouTube. And there's only 24 hours in a day. There are 7 days in a week. It's a fixed amount of time. And so if at the benefit of, say, a service like YouTube getting this many more eyeballs, these eyeballs had to have been removed from something else 15 years ago, 20 years ago, before YouTube was this popular. And I think that I think we're going to continue to see how, say, the next set of music labels and music artists are going to be found. A lot of them are starting now on YouTube and getting discovered on YouTube, right? We're going to start seeing that, you know, is there going to be as much budget that's going to be placed in the hands of Hollywood and movies, rather than putting it more in the hands of the content creators on YouTube? And so I think that I think we're still seeing the consequences of how that's going to all play out, because it's such a radical shift that's happened in such a short amount of time, in less than really 5-10 years before this monetization came about. But there's so much money that's going now into YouTube. But I do wonder what the larger impact is going to be in the all the other content creation forms that were there and available before YouTube came about.
Yeah, true. And Steve, you know, with short form content like TikTok and Reels exploding, you actually mentioned this now. So I want to ask, what do you think is the future of long form video?
I mean, I think that it's to me, a video is not just a video. It's just not a video. I mean, I think that there's different types of. Yeah. And just because the format is a video doesn't mean that it's the same across the board. Just like photos could be used to be showing, documenting something, to capture a moment, but then it could be used for a selfie or for a memory. I think for video, same thing. I think that definitely in the form of short form content, I think it's more the checkboxes are in the area of, look, I have 5, 10, 15 minutes of free time and I don't have that much time to really get into something. I have time to be able to watch maybe a few of these short form pieces of form content, and it's very quick to swipe through. But I do think that if it comes down to the ways that I use YouTube, for example, where it comes to learning about, well, it could be anything, whether it's learning about technology, the newest programming languages, or I really like photography. So learning about the newest cameras and the photographers using these cameras. My kids and I, when we do any of the things together, whether it's cooking in the kitchen or playing a video game, you know, you watch YouTube for that. And that's not short form content. That's there to get something out of this video. It's to solve a problem, right? And I think that there's always going to be a need for that, is what is the best way to be able to find a solution, a lesson, a class, to be able to address the things that you're interested in. And I think that that's going to be, it's going to be based on the quality of the content. And usually that quality is not in the form of, you know, 30 seconds to a minute or 2 minutes of content.
Yeah. Steve, what's the next YouTube moment in tech? What excites you the most today?
Well, I think I'll go back to like what we were talking about earlier on, right? Is I think that in some ways, I think it's a very fun adventure for me to explore in Silicon Valley itself. Has a few million people compared to the billions of people around the world. Now, like, is there a way to be able to somehow be able to connect with, to be able to utilize, to be able to propel these people all around the world, to be able to give them the resources to be able to create content? And so for me, like, I do believe that there's going to be the uprising of more globalization and generalization when it comes to new ideas being formed. There's still going to be a lot of innovation, a lot of startups, but it's not going to be all coming from the San Francisco Bay Area anymore. And to me, it's an uphill battle for me here trying to do it in Taiwan, because there are many times when I go into a situation and I think, oh, like, you don't even have to fix this problem because this is already fixed in Silicon Valley. But if we were to be able to fix this problem here in Taiwan, we would be able to gain a lot of the benefits that's missing from Silicon Valley, right? And so I think, like, that's been interesting. And I think that we're starting to see some areas, like places like Singapore, where there's starting to be more companies that are being formed that are global in nature, but that's actually being created outside of Silicon Valley. So that to me is the where I'm spending most of my time doing my own investments, my advising, as well as doing some of the travels and the talks, is to go around to places outside of Silicon Valley to explore what's the potential of doing something here instead of in Silicon Valley.
Nice, 100%. Steve, so speaking about, replicating these cultures and creating great ecosystems, a lot of it has to do with educating young entrepreneurs or aspiring founders. You've had huge success with YouTube, but there's often a glamorized narrative around startup life. What's the reality of building a billion-dollar company that most aspiring founders don't realize?
You know, I would actually say that it's a little bit different from what you suggested, which I actually think that there aren't enough aspiring founders outside of Silicon Valley. Many of them, they consider somehow these people from Silicon Valley are superhuman in some ways, right? That they possess some superpowers. Yeah. And if they were to have tried the same thing at that same time with the same idea, they somehow wouldn't have been able to do it because they don't possess those same superpowers. And that's certainly the case here in Taiwan, which is, look, like, it doesn't take much time for you to realize when your idea does not work. But you can live the rest of your life almost regretting you never tried, and you had this idea but you never tried to do it. And the much bigger regret is if you had an idea that somebody else ended up doing that ended up being successful, that would be a big regret to say, oh, I had that idea, I wish I did that too. And I think that everybody, my encouragement is that, look, it really takes at most 6 months before you can build a prototype of an idea and you can get it out there to the market and you can test it. And those 6 months, it's going to be a lot of work, but it's going to be filled with memories, unique memories that you can't get working for just a much larger company. And it's going to be just, whether or not that idea works or not, it's going to be just a great experience that can't be replicated in any other way. And of course, if it works, even to, it doesn't have to be the next YouTube, it doesn't have to be the next Google or Facebook or whatever, but as long as it takes off, there's such a great positive feeling when you see users using your service, you know, the way that you want them to use your service. And then you look at it and say, well, maybe we can make these adjustments, making these changes. And then if that also makes it more, it takes off, there's just, it's this continuous cycle of monitoring how, you know, your product is being used, adapting it to the current users, making these changes always. And it's a very addictive, but I think it's there's nothing else like that when you have your own ideas. And of course, when it starts taking off, you know, there's no better feeling than seeing users use your product. You don't need a boss to tell you that you're doing a good job. Your users tell you that.
Amazing, Steve. I love the answers and the positive approach to it. So actually, what was the most fun, speaking like kind of continuing on that note, what was the most fun or memorable part of building YouTube for you? Is there a particular story or a moment that still makes you laugh today?
Yeah, of course, like we sold it at a pretty early time, right? And so but I think that the early tales, the early experiences that really ring in my mind are the early days when you're just getting, what should I say, you know, glances as to the rest of your user base telling you that your idea may have a future. And so, for example, I still remember the first few videos that received over 1 million video views. And Nike was one of those people that uploaded one of the first videos with Ronaldinho juggling this soccer ball, right? And I it took a while because they uploaded it under this username, Joe B or something. It was trying to be anonymous, not to name it Nike. But for us to see that video and then for us to connect it up that was Nike's marketing department, that was like I mean, for Nike's marketing department, which is usually pretty adventurous, they explore and they take, they're pretty courageous to use your service as a platform to try to do some viral marketing. That was like a big winner. And then, of course, like there's these moments where You see like the bigger shows like NBC and some of the bigger TV stations starting to upload clips from Saturday Night Live and things like that onto the service to be able to use the platform as a way to show content to people that may have missed it because they weren't there to watch the TV show when it aired. I think instances like that. I think when I saw, like, there was one time when I was watching the news and the news was using a YouTube video because that was the only, it was a small crime that happened. It was like a road car accident on the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. And I just remember turning on the news that night and the video that they used, they didn't have any other video, but it was actually someone else using their phone taking a video of that incident. And now we see that a lot more on just social media where it's not a official TV channel that's out there with their film crew taping this, but in fact it's just somebody that uploaded 15 seconds of their video from their phone. But when you started seeing that early on back in like 2007, 2008, you know, that's when you start realizing like there's a lot of potential here that just can't be done in the traditional media channels other than through YouTube.
Steve, looking back fresh out of PayPal, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I mean, I think that's an unfair question because I think that I consider myself to be just so lucky to have that experience of PayPal and learning what I learned through PayPal and then doing YouTube. I mean, the advice to my younger self is just, you know, you're a lucky guy and you get to go work at PayPal and you get to start YouTube. Don't do anything different. I think that I consider myself to be very fortunate at the age of 2021 to move to Silicon Valley, learning all the things through a successful startup, going through that dot-com crash, working with so many of these prominent folks that have created all the companies thereafter from PayPal, and then going and creating YouTube myself.
It's an amazing time to build, huh? So many great companies out of there. Steve, so you already told me a bit about what's next for Steve Chen. I know that you're coming to Europe soon to attend Valencia Digital Summit, you know, like one of Southern Europe's leading international tech events. What do you expect to see from Europe or maybe in particular from the Spanish tech community?
Well, I think it's really interesting because it's, now being out here in Asia a bit, certainly see that it's important to be able to see that, you know, an area has the entrepreneurs, the talent, the individual engineers, individual graphics, individual UI, UX, people that can create this create and build out ideas. And then you have investors, right? VCs or angel investors. I think all three of those groups need to be in place in order for a company to really be able to even form past the Series A phase to really start growing out. But I think it's also interesting geographically and then the sort of the history of the area. I think that certainly in Asia, being in Taiwan has been an interesting area. But then one of the challenges that we face in Taiwan is that most of the people on this island of 23 million people are not connected with the rest of the world, in that it's very isolated in many of the ways when it comes to commercial products, when it comes to knowing what life is like outside of Taiwan. And so when I, for example, built YouTube, it was just building something that I would use myself. But it happens to be also something that myself includes the rest of the US and in some ways the rest of the world. In Taiwan, it's been different because you often have to tell many of the entrepreneurs here, look, this product may be used in Taiwan, but this will not be used in the US. But they don't know that. It's not their fault. It's just that they've never lived in the US. And so when the actual entrepreneurs are not the end users themselves, it becomes a bit of a problem. I think that it'll be interesting to see because I think that in many ways in Spain and Europe, it's going to be in the core center of what the rest of the world, when it comes to adopting new products and new ideas and new ways of life. And so I think that in that aspect, it has a advantage that you just can't buy overnight, you know, that comes with being in Spain. So I think that'll be very interesting to see. But I think for me personally, it's just to be able to just get some of that energy, that vibe that you get when there's a group of people that are trying to do. When you get people in the room that's all focused on creating something, that are excited about the next wave of technology and next wave of new products and what products can do, that's always exciting. So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Amazing. Steve, thanks so much for the time. It's been amazing to have you on the show. I think the audience is going to love it. Steve, I hope to see you soon in Spain. And thanks again, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Thanks for making this time work.